special. I thought the race that stopped the nation was more than a kick us on. But we don't accept skin unless it's colored white. We're rough, we tough, we hunt to kill. We raise the Southern Cross beneath the starlit sky. We worship corporations and it shows from the things that we buy. Still we're socially below the status line.
Welcome to Progressive Podcast Australia. I'm Katie.
And I'm Nick.
And we opened with a song there.
Yeah. So the episode is going to be about Invasion Day, which is coming up in Australia on January the 26th. And so we played a song, Where the Bloody Hell Are Ya, which is a sort of satirical song about Australia by the band Local Resident Failure. They're a punk band and I think quite relevant to this issue. They've got an Indigenous singer, Indigenous Australian singer as well. So, yeah, it's quite a relevant song, sort of satirising Australia. And, yeah, on this episode, we're going to talk about Invasion Day. We're not going to talk about too much, but we're going to have Celeste Little from last year's Invasion Day event in Melbourne. And so these are basically alternative Indigenous events, which are, yeah, I guess, highlighting the true history of this day. It's celebrated in Australia, but as we'll find out, it's kind of nothing to celebrate this day. So there's often there's always Invasion Day events and Survival Day events led by Indigenous people around Australia. And just before we get into that, I should also mention we're going to launch a new crowdfunding campaign. We also did our first video as well. We're going to play that and launch a crowdfunding, and finally we're going to play the final part of my discussion with designer and anthropologist Michael Pallenmeyer. So yeah, heaps on this show. But I just thought we'd briefly mention there's maybe a little bit more momentum for the changing the date this year than previous years, or something has changed in that Triple J, which is a radio station here in Australia,
public broadcasting, youth radio station.
Mm-hmm. So they've always had the Hottest 100 on January the 26th,
which is where they count down the best 100 songs voted that year.
Exactly. So they've changed the date basically because of those concerns of, you know, I always
they did felt, a survey as well.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I always felt that, you know, it wasn't exactly as bad as like celebrating Australia Day, but I felt it lent much more in that direction than
well, in the
day.
Well, it's a party kind of vibe. Exactly. It's like the Hottest 100 parties exactly, and wait till the countdown. And yeah.
And so I felt it was much closer to like an Australia Day celebration than a Survival Day or Invasion Day event. Yeah. So, and yeah, 60% voted in favour, which is about the same number as the postal survey. So 40% of Australians are fucked in the hood, basically.
Well, it's a different demographic as
it
well.
It is, but even 40% of them. So that's kind of shitty. But yeah, I guess like that, it's good it was a majority voted in changing the date, but it's still shitty that 40% said no, keep it as it is, it's fine on January 26th.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised they got as many as 60, unfortunately.
Well, it's meant to be more sort of progressive.
Well,
music,
yeah, that's
and
why
stuff.
I think
like,
they did get a bit more, but it's funny because was it when we saw Cornel West speak and was he talking? Well, who was it that raised this fact? Like, we can't. How they have a black president, or they had a black president in America. We can't even imagine a world where there could be an Indigenous prime minister in Australia. Mm,
it may have been Cornel West. I'm not
and it's just
sure.
We can't even imagine it. It's that's how terrible things are.
Yeah. And it's good Triple J changed the date. It's shitty they've done this so long. But
it's already mentioned there's also been the councils, various councils in Victoria started it, council in Melbourne. Mm. No longer recognising that as a day of celebration. And then Fremantle Council followed.
Yep, that was good, yeah.
There was public outcry about it.
Yeah, but even their response, it said, we all agreed that the Hottest 100 shouldn't be part of a debate about the day it's on. The only debate should be about the songs, which I found a bit of like a depoliticised response.
Definitely like, very moderate.
It should have been like, we're in solidarity with Indigenous people and stuff. But yeah.
I know, but how much can they do when they're the public broadcaster?
Exactly.
The thing, they're government broadcaster.
Exactly, it's very tough, and therefore they're meant to share all views and all this stuff.
I mean, if you've got the community, because it's not community radio, station.
Mm-hmm.
Community radio stations are independent, but this is government, so
exactly.
it is
tough.
A bit more limited, whereas I imagine like the 3CR and the other community stations can be far more progressive and radical about it.
Yeah. So let's get into it now. So we're going to play a bunch of things here all back to back. So We're going to have a bit more of the opening song. We're going to have some comedy from Armour Aman on Australia Day. We're going to have a few chants from the Invasion Day rally in Melbourne. And then we're going to have Celeste Little's speech.
The rally last year.
Last Invasion Day event in Melbourne. And yeah, she's a trade unionist. She's a speaker, journalist.
Activist.
And so yeah, play her speech. I will put some content warnings this episode. There are some mentions of like genocide, massacres, these violent stuff. There's some Nazi analogies in terms of the genocide, but there isn't really like graphic specific cases or anything like that. We're just talking about these issues mainly. But I thought I'd mention that. But yeah, let's go straight to it.
They do this thing like every single Australia Day, right? They have the official celebration of Parliament House. And near the beginning, they find some Aboriginal people to do like some welcome ceremony or something. And then they say this thing that like makes my stomach turn. They're looking in the camera and the presenter always goes,
"And we thank our Indigenous Australians for the special role that they play in our history." And it makes me want to vomit. It's horrible, right? Because, all right, if you're going to take the Holocaust of someone else's civilization and turn that into a national holiday and teach your kids that that's a happy time of the year, that's fine. I'm not going to judge you. I'm lying. I hate that. But the people you destroy, like, why do you expect them to celebrate with you? Like, why do you make them be part of the celebration? That's sick. That's so cold-hearted. That's psychologically, that's a sick thing to do. That's crazy. That's so crazy. That's like ringing up a bunch of Jewish people and going, "Hey, guys, we were just going to throw a party for Adolf Hitler's birthday. And we were just wondering whether you guys would like to come along and do a little song and dance to kick everything off. Is that cool with you? Are you interested in that?" Because you're an important part of the story.
Hello? Hung up, I don't know. Everyone's so politically correct now. Yeah.
Australia. I'm a unionist, a feminist, and a social commentator. My traditional lands lie around Alice Springs, yet I was born in Canberra and have lived in Melbourne now for 25 years. So I too am a beneficiary of the displacement and massacres of the traditional owners here, while also being a victim of it back in my homeland. Before I go on, there's one final acknowledgement I wish to make, and that is to the warriors of the Aboriginal resistance. This collective of young Aboriginal men and women are responsible for almost every action and political statement on Indigenous rights in this country for the past few years. From the Stop the Force Closures rallies to the John Dale rally to previous Invasion Day rallies, they have been doing the hard work, speaking, networking, printing, marshalling and so forth. Our governments keep giving us reasons to protest, unfortunately, and they have been doing the legwork and gotten everyone out on the streets. It's testament to these strong young people, most of whom are women, that so many are gathered here today. And this Invasion Day, many of the war organisers elected instead to take a step back and attend regional events with families or go to the Canberra Convergence, or they're in the crowd as well. This is why you've got the pleasure of my company today and a smaller organising team. So can we please therefore acknowledge the work of the Warriors of the Aboriginal Resistance with a big round of applause. Here in Melbourne, we are referred to as the conscience of Australia. We're known for being more progressive than in other states and have a unique ability to get people out on the streets protesting against injustices at the drop of a hat. Who, for example, can forget last year's Border Force rally, which went from a Facebook post to a gathering on Flinders Street steps in mere hours? Yet despite Melbourne's, and indeed Victoria's, progressive nature, this state manages to remain incredibly complacent when it comes to recognising the rights of Indigenous people. No. Just down the road from us today, running at the same time as this rally, is the annual Australia Day parade. What's more, the organisers state that they are proud that Melbourne is the only capital city in Australia that runs a parade. We are therefore very, very good in this city at performing edginess and progressiveness rather than necessarily living it. So I would bet the turnout at this rally today is more than down the road. You might ask why someone like me, an Aboriginal woman who lives in Melbourne, who has all these fancy bits of paper next to her name and who is clearly doing okay, feels passionate enough about Invasion Day to call a rally and take a stand. For starters, I'm sick to death of the historical erasure which has to happen in this country for Australia Day festivities to go ahead. To me, Australia Day has always been Invasion Day, and it was a day of protest when I was growing up. We don't celebrate Australia Day in this country because we're apparently a unified, multicultural society who have a right to be proud of what we've achieved. We celebrate it because we are content to ignore the declaration of terra nullius and the crimes which have been perpetuated against Indigenous people beyond this point. Because this country is okay with denying frontier wars took place. They're okay with forgetting the massacres. They're okay with forgetting the slavery, the stealing of children, the setting up of concentration camps and missions. They're fine with the fact that Aboriginal people are being forced to live under a foreign regime that they never consented to, nor has that regime ever come to the table to negotiate agreement. Worse though, they're okay with the goodwill which was generated around the 1967 referendum, the Wade-Hill walk-off and the walk across the Harbour Bridge, key elements where black and white Australia pulled together for a more positive future, to be forgotten. This is a travesty. I may be sitting here pretty in Melbourne, sipping my soy lattes, enjoying the craft beers, but this year marks 10 years since the Northern Territory intervention was launched, and I have family who are living under it still. Whose money is being quarantined and who are forced to undertake 25 hours per week of unpaid work, which anywhere else would attract a wage and benefit. Whose houses are falling down around their ears despite the fact that the Australian government promised as part of the intervention to have new housing. Communities having their water cut off by the Northern Territory government in a bid to force people to leave and move to other areas. Hi. The town camp my own grandmother lived at with young children while my Aboriginal grandfather was off fighting in World War II as a non-Australian citizen had its water cut off by the previous government for this very reason.
Shame.
Proposals for fracking operations and nuclear waste dumps on Aboriginal lands just keep coming while we look over the pond and can state the Dakota Access Pipeline is a travesty. Most people are unaware that similar operations are going on right here, right under their noses. It's more than this though. In Western Australia, they're still trying to force people off their lands. The right to live on country and practice culture is not a given. Meanwhile, in Queensland, the government has struck a deal with a coal miner and to which the local community have been protesting non-stop due to the damage to heritage, the land, the reef and site. It's 2017 and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people still don't have land rights. All over the country, country, we are waiting for the return of stolen wages. We continue to be the most impoverished group in this country with significantly higher school dropout rates and unemployment rates. We have the highest rate of youth suicide in the world. Here in Victoria, Aboriginal people are incarcerated 11 times what our population parity rates would be. It's 2017 and Aboriginal people still don't have human rights.
Shame!
Finally though, I can't help but be angry. I'm the auntie of two nephews and one niece now, and I don't want them growing up to be made to feel that their ancestors were worthless and their history doesn't matter like I was within mainstream of this society. I want them to understand that they come from the longest continuing cultures in the world and to be allowed to be proud of that. I want the people in this country to also be proud of them. I want them to be able to learn truth so they grow up strong and committed to ensuring that these injustices never happen again. So I'm not going to thank people for coming here today. Instead, I'm glad you walk in solidarity with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people for truth and justice. And it is my opinion that anyone with any decency would do the same. We need to start creating more people who possess this decency, because in my view, they don't reside in Parliament House. The justice is going to come from the streets and not from the exclusionary colonial system. Thank you.
So you can listen to the audio of that entire event. I recorded it all, so it's up there. We'll also put up some pics in the show notes as well. And yeah, we also covered Invasion Day and also had discussion around nationalism back on episode 22. So I'll put a link up today if you want to hear more about these issues. But yeah, it was a really cool event last year. They estimated to be about 50,000 people were there in Melbourne last year.
Wow.
So yeah, it was really great. I've been there every year. I've been in Melbourne, the Invasion Day event's always worth going along. So the next one is, yeah, this is in Melbourne, is obviously 26th of January, 11 a.m. at Parliament Steps in, Parliament Steps on Spring Street. And yeah, they encourage an activist to bring flowers to lay on the steps of Parliament. There's also a lunch after in Treasury
Gardens.
It's
doing the hashtag abolish the date or something.
Yeah, well, I'm going to, abolish Australia Day is this year. So that's what we'll probably call this episode, because that's what has sort of come out of the Indigenous community around that. And so this is organised by War Again, the Warriors of Aboriginal Resistance. And Celeste spoke about the great work they did in her talk, which we just heard. So I'll put a link up to the Melbourne event, and you can definitely look up online events near you. And yeah, if there are any other events, definitely, I mean, there will be in all major cities. So definitely you're welcome to share them, pass them on to us, and we'll share them around. So yeah, we'll get into our crowdfunding video here. So this is, we're basically trying to raise some money to buy some new equipment. And so, yeah, we'll put a link to the video if you'd like to watch this. It's like a visual thing as well, so you can watch it. But for those who rather listen to the audio, here it is. Hi, and welcome to Progressive Vodcast Australia.
Vodcast.
It's a video cast.
I think you're talking about Vod and Fresh Meat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. We're, video, so get to see our beautiful faces. What are we talking about today, Nick?
Well, we're talking about our crowdfunding campaign that we've got going. So basically, we need some more equipment, as you can see with these mics. This one's really great, this mic stand.
This is awesome.
Yep.
The other mic stand, not so good, although some board games, multiple purposes there for gaming and also for stands.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the extent of our setup. So we're not trying to be greedy and upgrade to ultra 4K, even if you could do that with audio. Well, you know, or 3D microphones or anything fancy like that.
Mm-hmm.
We just want, basically to get something like this.
Exactly. And I think it would be much better quality, but also I wouldn't be kind of hunched over a mic as well. So I think it would help with the overall vibe.
To keep things moving.
And also we've got, this is my cousin's old mic. We had a mic like that and it broke. So it'd be nice, like ideal sound quality of both coming in the same mic. So we wanted to get another one of those as well. So
that's the reason for the crowdfunding, and it'll be running until the end of February.
Mm-hmm. 23rd of February, we'll cut it off. And
so yeah. What do you get if you give
what
money?
What do you get?
Nick?
Well,
because people only give if they get.
Yeah, I thought this year what we'd do, or this time what we'd do, is actually listeners who donate can actually have a chance to choose what topics we do.
So you've got a few topics set, right?
Not anything at all, but we've got a bunch of topics. Prison abolition, living car free, like practical advice.
Homelessness,
mental health, skepticism and rationality. We've got a whole long list on our website.
So whatever floats your boat, you want to vote for that one.
Exactly. I realised
John was always after anti-capitalist episodes.
Yeah, exactly. We've got a bunch of anarchist topics on there as well.
So you get to pick one of those.
Mm-hmm. So we'll have the list there, and so you can pick one of those. Also, so basically anyone who donates at least $10 gets to pick an episode.
You've got a little, one of our new girls. Staffies coming in there, picture there.
They're not girls, they're 37-year-old women.
Girls. So we got little...
Yeah, if you donate $5, then you get a shout out on the show. And if you donate more than 10, get pick an episode, you get badges.
A patch or a badge.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's about it. Maybe just before we go, just want to briefly touch on the importance of the podcast. Or that sounds
know, we've been doing it for 6 years.
Yeah.
We're both social justice activists. My day job is social justice lawyer work, mm-hmm. and Nick does academia, but with a focus on social justice.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's kind of the lives we lead, and we do activism as well. So I just think giving a voice to independent media in Australia is really important.
Exactly.
And we try to cover topics, you have the more mainstream progressive media. We try to cover topics that even they wouldn't really be covering.
Yeah.
Because things, like anarchism, veganism, ending homelessness is something we want to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think also recently going to an animal liberation action and having Patty Mark from Animal Liberation Victoria, and she just spoke to Channel 7 media, Channel 7 News, with mainstream news outlet here in Australia. And then after speaking to me, she said, that was so relaxing. It was so great to speak to an activist media. And I've had the same with refugee activists as well. So I think it's really important in the spirit of independent media, activist media, actually have a voice where activists can get their message out beyond a few seconds.
Sophie's coming into the picture a bit.
In the mainstream media. But yeah, giving activists a chance to get their message across from media who are on board with their message.
Yeah, it's nice. And to talk in this activist space, people are already progressive. We're not trying to convince them to be progressive, but saying, okay, you're already, into veganism. Whatever. Have you thought about anarchism? You thought about women's rights? Whatever it is.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's it. So, yeah, we appreciate any support. The goal is 200. If we get to 100, we'll buy a stand. If we get to 200, we'll buy a stand and a new mic. That'll be
ideal.
Look
for the links.
Yep, the link will be in the description for this video. So,
description.
Yeah. Description, and the campaign will be through chuff.org.
Cool. Thank you, everyone. Now I sit and still everyone's already.
We stay the best of friends. We put a link up in the show notes for this episode for that crowdfunding campaign. You can also find it on our website, progressivepodcastaustralia.com, and click on the donate button. The link is there as well. Thanks to Emil for doing that video for us.
Nick's cousin,
who
we've chatted about and had on the podcast and everything. And so
check out his photography at emilraji.com, emilraji.com. And yeah, we both quite enjoyed doing that those videos, Emil did such a great job with it as well.
It's very
so
professional.
Yeah, if anyone, if people liked it, would like us to do more, we might be open to occasionally doing that, not whole episodes, but maybe just doing little 5-10 minute segments on a particular issue or whatever might be cool to do.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, let us know if you're a progressivepodcast@gmail.com or social media on a website or whatever. Also, yeah, just after that video, I just exited out it with a bit of bomb the music industry, and I thought that was quite relevant. The lyric in there, that song, making $110 for 20 hours of work, and I guess it was quite relevant because they Definitely not in their lyrics, but just the way they did things were quite revolutionary. And then years before it became a thing, they gave away their music for free, and people just paid what they feel, which paid what they felt, which is obviously not very as kind of part of the song, isn't necessarily a good financial move. But I really like that model, I guess. And obviously that's what we do with the podcast. Everyone gets it for free, but if anyone does want to chip into that campaign, we greatly appreciate it. So we're going to finish up the episode. In the second half, we're going to play my discussion with Michael Pellmeyer. And so this is the final part of the discussion, which we've been playing the last few episodes. You can listen to the talk we're discussing back on episode 196. And we also elaborated on some of the themes on episode 197 and again here. And we talk about some issues around science, about designers say they're increasing engagement for the sake of people. It is actually more about getting hooked. And we speak about social media as an example of that. Individual versus structural solution, lots of different stuff. So, here is the final part of my discussion with Mike. And I really found your points interesting, like talking about, witchcraft and more traditional forms of medicine and how... how they were previously more women focused, and it wasn't, as you mentioned, that the sort of mainstream or Western medicine was subsidized, so they get that for free, but they still went to the more traditional forms of medicine because of for other reasons beyond financial. And I have heard lots of critiques of science, but usually it's more like science is bad because of capitalism, for example, so that the things that make money are funded rather than the things that help society. And I was wondering about that points about gender too, your points about, sort of Western medicine being very like often male doctor focused rather than like female patient focused. And I'm just wondering your thoughts on, do you see these problems you raise as like, this is a problem with science, or is science more a reflection of problematic aspects in society, or a bit of both?
It's an interesting question, and I think there are many answers to it, but it's clearly something around ideology. So, I mean, for example, if Bridget Jordan, the anthropologist that I spoke about during my talk, and her talking about, forget the name of her book, but about childbirth, essentially. And so I guess if we didn't live in patriarchal societies, would she have... done that ethnography at all? Would she have found women being disempowered in high technology? Would it have actually been a site of interest? And I think that kind of raises the other question of, how do we actually see science and the tools that science produces? And would the application of tools like, science and modern technologies, would they would be absolutely be different, the application of them, if our ideologies shifted? But at the same time, science and modern technologies are absolutely things that embody those ideologies regardless of how we use them. And that also has kind of implications in another debate that's happening around, is technology neutral? And which is another interesting one. And I think it applies to all of these elements, all of these components around science and rationality and technology, is, are they things that we could use for better? Or are they also things that are inherently encoded with, white, heteropatriarchal capitalist narratives, and that they're limited in how we can use them? So I think there's kind of, on the one hand, of course, how things are used depend on how we choose to use them. Like, we can take, a knife, for example. A knife can be used for many, many different things. You can kill people randomly. You can chop veggies, carve like a wood sculpture, or cut ropes that bind someone's hands together or something like that. Mm-hmm. And which is, a knife is a pretty, a tool that you can use for many different things. But then if you actually think about something else, like, say there's just a single red button, and you press that red button and its only function is to explode. It's kind of like, is it really neutral then, that red button and its function? The knife clearly has more applications as a tool, but if that red button is only designed to explode, there's really no other way to use that red button. And I think that science and capitalist modernity, all of its components are, in many ways, made for one function, and we can use them for many different things, but they are ultimately encoded with that stuff that does, inherently cause alienation, does also try to quantify the world in certain terms, often, dominated by white male narratives. so that those things can be programmed, so that they can be governed in a way that is defined by a certain dominant, terms of order. And so I think there are really limitations in how that stuff can be applied, because obviously the goal of in that scenario with Bridget Jordan around disempowerment in childbirth, what actually is, how could you use that differently? You know, in the Mayan scenario, the woman is the source of knowledge. In the high technology scenario, it's ultimately, you know, data machines and technicians and things like that. Is there any way that taking power away from a woman could be any different? Is the objective ultimately to examine and assess what might happen in childbirth, or is it actually about something? Is there another objective there? And I think that there's a lot there around what actually are the objectives in life and in childbirth. So on the one hand, so in Seychelles, for example, because it's an African country, so there's a really strong objective there to actually, have low, maternal, infant deaths in childbirth, because that's a kind of prominent measure of how developed an African country is. So then in order to do that, they kind of there are C-sections, left, right, and center, to just about anything, to ensure that a child is born alive without considering the costs of doing a C-section later on in life, and the difficulty of the woman going through that surgery and then having to recover from that surgery, and so on. So it ultimately becomes about some kind of objective measure, and that is the child being born alive, without thinking of the costs and consequences of doing that stuff. And so I think that it depends on how that stuff is used. Is that kind of a who makes those decisions, I guess, is what I'm saying there, and that that defines essentially how that tool is used.
Yeah, and in terms of things being designed a certain way, which is a point you made around design in your talk, that we designers design things to increase engagement, like to get people hooked, but yet that really serves companies, not people. And I just thought of, and I mean, you've probably possibly looked into this yourself, but I just thought of social media as a really key example of that. And is that something you've looked into at all?
So it was the thing that I kind of raised in my talk. Can't remember if it was this one or a previous one, but just around how obviously a lot of the things that we design, and again, we call it human-centered design, and we design things in order to increase engagement, lower barriers to consumption, and things like that. And we like to frame these things, such as social media, as we're actually making ways for people to connect better, without actually considering that it is actually more isolating in some ways, and actually becomes addictive when we find out ways to engage people so that they actually keep using it and become addicted to it, because then we measure success or profit on things like engagement, because then there's more exposure to ads and things like that. So I think there is that, once again, fundamentally comes down to what the ideological motive is behind all of that, because if it is ultimately about profit, and the belief is that generating profit is then somehow going to magically lead to good things happening, then that's what people do, and there are costs, and we don't assess, actually, just like C-sections in childbirth, we don't actually assess the means of getting to that end, and it's glazed over, and we just use that measure as a target in itself and assume good things will happen, which is actually a very kind of superstitious component of capitalism.
And I remember seeing a while ago that Facebook was designed quite deliberately around that dopamine hit people get when their posts get liked or whatever, that it was actually quite deliberate, and as you say, that is successful for the company. But it's led to all kinds of issues around addiction to social media, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So it's again, I think, a way of framing, well, what is it, just because we can do it, should we do it? Is it good, kind of thing? Is it actually beneficial to design something where it allows people to engage and access things whenever they like on their mobile 24/7? If that's something that they want to do, is it also something that is good to have happen? And there's many different kind of paternalistic elements of having that discussion, where it's like, you know, should we do that? What's good for people? Should we decide that? Who are the people deciding that? But I think there needs to be some kind of engagement with things like the very concept of quality of life, for example. What does it actually mean to have a high quality of life? And I think there was an article I was reading that was kind of broke these down into, well, there's kind of our needs and there are our desires, and they're the kind of components of what makes a high quality of life. When we've satisfied both of those things, then we have a high quality of life. But the problem with that is that when we have many desires and those desires are increasing and always we have new desires because we're not satisfied by our previous desires, and those desires, that's actually an unsustainable thing. And we have desires, and if we fail to actually satisfy those desires, then we don't actually have a high quality of life because we are unsatisfied, and quality of life is ultimately about satisfaction. And so in Stone Age Economics, Marshall Sahlins kind of raises hunter-gatherers and kind of talks a little bit about how because their needs were so, you know, and this is kind of him generalizing a bit, but he does point to some specific instances, because, you know, basic needs are so basic, and there is no kind of like excessive material culture in the same sense as there is in industrial modern society, it is much easier to satisfy needs and desires because there aren't many of them. And so therefore they have in many ways a higher quality of life than we do in modern Western culture, because even though our needs are being met, we have really unsustainable desires. So then it kind of raises the question of, well, if we desire actually engaging with social media 24/7 in the most convenient way and all other services, is that actually going to be satisfying to do that? And that's it's kind of more of a philosophical question around how we approach the huge potential of using technology in different ways, but also the huge costs and impacts on things like mental health and quality of life when it comes to satisfaction.
Yeah, and I think bringing it back to critiques of capitalism as well, the fact that, you know, a lot of people feel deprived under capitalism, but not because their needs haven't been met, but because their desires haven't been met. But those desires are very much shaped by capitalism, by advertising, by companies, these kind of things, which try and make us think if we haven't got whatever, the latest car, latest iPhone, that we're kind of missing out. So, yeah, I think that can, in a way, help to explain mental health issues, the fact that we feel deprived when we aren't necessarily, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And there is a kind of component of that in tech culture where people do kind of talk about, efficiency as kind of being a primary thing. It's like efficiency is a good thing. So we talk about efficiency as, and we almost conflate it with sustainability a lot of the time. We're like, if we make things more efficient, that means there's lower impact because we're not using as much. But because that efficiency is functioning within a capitalist paradigm, it doesn't mean that we stop doing things, we stop consuming things and stop producing things. It actually means that we then, you know, I say we, obviously I'm talking about the capitalist paradigm, use that those extra resources that we have now freed up because things are more efficient to then produce more and consume more. And that's my kind of overarching critique of something like Tesla and Elon Musk, is because he's actually making a kind of alternative that is more efficient and has lower impact when it comes to transportation networks and technology. But what he's actually doing by doing that is lowering the running costs of what is essentially an unsustainable concept, which is the concept of an interconnected world through transport systems. And he's actually enabling an exponential growth logic to occur by reducing the costs of it. So everyone's kind of celebrating this idea of efficiency when it comes to Elon Musk. But I actually see it as a really, really dangerous scenario, because he isn't actually challenging the fundamental logic of exponential growth, and he's actually enabling it. So I actually see him as a danger to it, instead of actually someone that's actually going to be, you know, saving everyone from climate change or something like that.
Exactly. As stuff gets more efficient, we tend to use more, like air travel is a really good example that it has got more efficient, but as a result, we do it a lot more. So those any efficiency gains have been overridden by the increased use. So
yeah absolutely. Yeah. And we only need to kind of backcast to Ford, how transportation culture emerged in the first place, to just see how that occurred. And I'm baffled as to why anyone thinks that more cars just with a different kind of fuel system would somehow be a good thing when actually cars and transportation is the problem. It's just like,
exactly. Yeah. There's so many problems with cars, like beyond even just environmental impacts in terms of the, I did most of a town planning degree, just like the design of cities and the cul-de-sacs and all these things, which have all these kind of like isolating people getting stuck in the suburbs. Like there's so many like safety on the streets. So it was much safer before cars and all these kind of issues. And environmentally there's problems with these e-cars, but even beyond environmentally, like car dominated cities, there's so many social problems as well.
Exactly. And so he's actually enabling that to happen at a faster rate with lower costs. We should see it as lower cost instead of lower emissions or something like that. But there's also something that Caroline Ruse said in her keynote at EPIC conference, which was about, it's really kind of like reductionist to see pollution only as CO2. Those people clearly haven't seen all the e-waste that's piling up in Ghana, you know, and I think it's those kind of that externalization that occurs that allows people to see something like Tesla as a fantastic solution, because what they're trying to do is keep doing what we're currently doing, maintaining the privileges that we currently have, and then kind of seeing that we're solving a problem and then externalizing the costs onto, you know, people in Ghana, onto people in the Congo that might be mining because there's a limited amount of cobalt, you know, and all of those consequences we don't actually consider to be. Those are, you know, as Zizek put it, those are the objective occurrences. They're not actually connected to the capitalist system.
So, yeah, it's definitely a discussion which you raise in your talk and also something we've had some ongoing discussions on the podcast about, doing what we can as individuals and not totally dismissing that, but at the same time, not purely focusing on individual solutions to the extent that we ignore the broader structural issues as well. Anything else you want to add around that topic?
So this is, again, like as I mentioned before, this is ultimately, I think, where the most friction is occurring when it comes to the kind of leftist approach to how we address and approach some of these wicked problems. It makes it really difficult because I mean, obviously they work together, but we shouldn't see individual approaches as the be all and end all of how we might approach this, which is where those things definitely turn into red herrings, I think. So there is a kind of split in this discussion where there are those who want to, you know, tweak capitalism, believe in consumer power and ethical consumption, but also kind of like, subscribing to the discussions that around equality and things like that have been co-opted by, you know, capitalism, where it's like, instead of talking about equality as actually getting rid of hierarchies, we should have equality as diversity in leadership and things like that, and all these kind of liberal notions that make capitalist exploitation look decent and provide outlets and examples of how it's not so bad and can even be good and things like that. And, you know, that might be kind of one approach to change, to actually get people in power to actually change things so that they have the power to do things. But obviously that is not what's happening. That's not the objective. It's not being seen as a path to something else. So it is, once again, it's essentially the biggest red herring of them all, because having diversity, the wealthiest people and most powerful class, that's not actually equality, to just have, you know, minorities in power, because ultimately those things are predicated on equality. So it's bizarre that in this kind of individualist approach, we've come to see symbols of inequality as equality. We've come to see people making individual decisions based on consumption as a solution to the problem, where consumption is actually the problem. And it's a very bizarre kind of way that it's happening. And even seeing things like philanthropists repurposing their wealth toward, you know, social impact projects, you know, obviously that's not ethical or socially or ecologically beneficial, ultimately, holistically, because how they made their money was unethical and socially and ecologically destructive in the first place. But that's not being considered in this, because it's purely being seen on what the individual does versus the kind of structural dynamics around how those things came to be in the first place. So my view on that is that essentially we shouldn't see the structures we have as neutral, just as, you know, things like technology. And we shouldn't see equality as simply diversity within exploitative and unequal structures, because those structures are biased. It's not just about the individuals. And so there's this quote from Winston Churchill where he says, "We shape our buildings, thereafter they shape us." And I'll never quote Churchill otherwise than to show that the economic and political ruling class know full well what they're doing and they know what they have the power to do. But it kind of reflects what something that, like, you know, Bruno Latour says about technology as society made durable. And I think kind of both of these statements reflect how the structures are encoded with the values of kind of white ableist heteropatriarchy. And we can't imagine that they would produce much else and ignore how they've shaped our behavior accordingly. So there's kind of, on the one hand, where it's encouraging to articulate that, you know, yes, we humans are the ones that made these things that are the problems, so perhaps we can address them. And that's, you know, something that David Graeber says when he says, it's kind of a quote about the hidden truth of the world is that that it's something that we make and could just as easily make differently, which is, you know, a very exciting quote, and I think points to just how powerful ideology is, that we're kind of functioning on this terrain of ideology, and we just need to think about it differently and do it differently because we are recreating capitalism every day, and we could just as easily not recreate capitalism. But then I think it that kind of glazes over some of the structural components that are actually very difficult to address, and also raises the question of who's we? You know, when we're talking about we could make it differently, who is we in that statement? You know, like, for example, Tony Abbott and Kim Beazley, you know, with the funds of other wealthy white men, have cited a university of Western civilization, you know, henceforth referred to as the University of White Supremacy. That's just the only thing that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. So what they've actually done there is kind of make an institution with immense power and backing. And so, yes, it is humans who make structures, just as Tony Abbott and Kim Beazley and other powerful white men have made the University of Western Civilization. But, I mean, who else can just up and start an institution? You know, I think it demonstrates just how limited the individual approach is to change when the wealthy and powerful can, on the one hand, cut funds to universities that aren't translating to economic value, whilst then starting their own privately funded university that promotes white supremacy. And, you know, I admit that kind of, on the one hand, some of the best and most powerful jobs in the world do require you to be indoctrinated and well-conditioned in white supremacy. So that probably will actually translate to great economic opportunities for the students that go to that university. But, you know, I think you get my point that it's kind of like, who are the people actually creating these institutions, creating the structures, and how can individuals actually approach that stuff to change them? And I think a part of this this discussion is kind of like something that Audre Lorde says around, you know, the master's tools cannot be used to dismantle the master's house, where she said, what does it mean when the tools of a racist patriarchy are used to examine the fruits of that same patriarchy? And she says, you know, it means that the only, the most narrow perimeters of change are possible and allowable. So we can only have kind of really narrow approaches to doing things when we ultimately see the structures as the things that are a given and we don't need to change them and shouldn't be changing them. And so that's, I mean, that's right where I am in this discussion when it comes to individual versus structural, is that the structural things are the problem. It's not just about individual behavior, and we need those approaches to fundamentally examine and challenge the values and structures of the modern world in order to actually change, instead of just saying that we should change our individual behavior.
Yeah, I totally agree with all that. And just to add a couple of things to that, from recent discussion, we had a podcast episode about the Me Too campaign and the solution of more female CEOs and the way in which that distracts from the negative impact that company or corporations have on women and as on people as a whole as well. And also thinking of the state as well, I recently read a book by Naomi Klein, No Is Not Enough, about the Trump administration, and she raised the point that like with Obama in the White House, that led a lot of people to say, oh, we're post-racial, racism's over in America. But during the period Obama was in the White House, there was actually increased inequality, economic inequality specifically, between white and African-American people. And so, yeah, like, so it sort of, inequality got worse, but people didn't address that inequality because we had that one individual as a figurehead in the White House. And so, yeah, we do need to look at these structures and not just a few people, like, sort of getting into these high positions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why I'm so frightened of these things, because of how powerful they are. And they are absolutely red herrings. It's not, you know, Barack Obama was a black president, but he was, you know, this is something that Angela Davis says. He was still the president of the white supremacist United States. You know, it's just like, well, actually, that what does it mean to just change a president when you're operating machinery that is fundamentally exploitative and racist and sexist and all the other things? But yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it kind of reminds me a bit of, I remember seeing, it was like totally conspiracy kind of doco, and a lot of it was pretty bizarre, but just like the first few minutes, quite interesting, because they had like the figurehead change, but below was all the same, so you have the changing face of the president, but there's still, you know, the military and the, you know, different sort of aspects of power within the government that don't necessarily change just with a changing president.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So I heard someone else kind of refer to this recently about how we should be angry that we've got a system, well, not we, but well, actually we in many ways, that there is a system where we only have kind of two choices when it comes to voting for someone. So this example was talking about Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. And it was essentially saying that it's ridiculous to think that just because the imprint on the other side of the coin is different means that it's a fundamentally different thing when they're still both, you know, sides of a coin, and it's the coin perhaps that is the problem. It's just like a interesting way to look at it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so before we go, just give you a chance to like plug anything, any websites, Twitters, anything like yourself, or also anything you'd recommend listeners check out to hear more about what we've discussed.
Yeah, so I guess there's a Slack group that we kind of have. So this is something that came out of the talks that I was giving and the discussions that we were having. And it's called How Might We Do Good? And it's as expected, it sounds cliche because it is the idea is to have a generic kind of appeal to get a whole bunch of people talking about this, having concerns about this, and trying to shift the narrative a little bit and have different ways forward. Some of them that I won't agree with, some of them that I do agree with, some of them that I don't agree with. But inevitably, a whole bunch of people trying to find ways forward for, you know, kind of meaningful change. So I guess that's kind of like one thing that I'd put out there is that is openly available, and that's I've got a kind of pinned tweet on my Twitter where you can just go to that tweet, and the link to an invite is there, and it would be great to have kind of more people with a more kind of radical leaning to enter into that discussion to really kind of enrich that stuff there. So that's open to anyone who wants to join it, basically.
Cool. So we'll put if that's right, we'll put a link up to your Twitter in the show notes, if that, then people can check that out.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
it's just at Michael Pellmeyer, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All right, so we'll link to that at the notes, progressivepodcastaustralia.com. Any final thoughts you want to leave us with, anything you didn't get to, or, anything you want to finish with?
So I guess maybe to finish up is just kind of the emphasis on the, you know, back to the individual structural approaches thing is that just that I do want to emphasize that there is a huge structural component to all of this stuff, and it is really necessary to have that lean, to have that discussion about the structures and not keep kind of falling back to the very individualist approach to this as the only approach, because that, you know, once again, to overuse the term, is the red herring. Because we do need to understand that there is, in those institutions and structures, they are encoded with all of the kind of ideologies that are fundamentally problematic to begin with. Our education is capitalist, law is capitalist, tools are capitalist. So it's no wonder that people find it so hard to imagine anything else. It's literally the only world that many people know. So instead of trying to reform these things, I think, you know, we should really be, you know, placing an emphasis on thinking in terms of outcomes, agnostic of institutions and organizations, and then perhaps seeing them as barriers and problems in and of themselves, if that's what they are. And then kind of seeking to, you know, emphasizing that there is, it is a reality and a way forward to look to dismantle kind of institutions and organizations and then create new things in their place instead of just thinking in within the paradigm that we have. So emphasizing, you know, structural emphasis there.
Yeah, well, thanks so much it's great that you're raising these issues in the design community, and thanks for the talk, and thanks for this Mic Uncensored that you've given us as well. I've really enjoyed it, and hopefully listeners have got something out of it as well.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Pete. Great to be there.
I enjoyed speaking to Mike, and he's actually happy to come back on the show at some point. So if anyone does have any feedback on that, get in touch, and he can probably address that himself sometime on the show.
Right, these critics?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
To you who said that! You're a fucking dickhead.
So we'll link.
Come to... and say it to me in person, mate. Come on, come on.
We'll link to the crowdfunding campaign.
That's what Mike sounds like, as you can tell. I did a spot-on impersonation.
Yeah, well, you
there.
Can compare the two, I guess. We're going to finish up with a song which relates back to the initial theme of the episode of Invasion Day. And so this song is by Kev Carmody, Thou Shalt Not Steal, in terms of Australia being stolen. Actually, it was passed on by my mum. So
your mum?
Yeah.
But... not like, oh, you should have had this on your podcast. Or
no, anything. No, but just like, oh, this was a good song about Indigenous issues. Mm. So, yeah. Any final thoughts?
Mick's mum, quite the revolutionary.
Cool. That was it. Oh, okay. I thought that was your final thought, but you can say
I was going to say more.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I guess in some ways she has been. She had to go argue something to about... this is one of our new staffies, Penny, on the mic there. She had to argue about not having changing her name. Not,
yeah.
Because she kept, when she got married to dad for tax reasons. I mean, they both did. Not like she just like married him for tax reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is quite funny. And they were like giggling through their vows and stuff. Mm. Yeah, the kind of the hippies in the 70s.
Mm.
But so she, when they bought the house, there was a whole kerfuffle about her not having the same name as your dad, right? Because,
well, it had to be under the husband's name or something. And I think she could have been part of it and just said, like, Kerry Pendergrass, my dad's surname. But, yeah, she didn't want to do that. So I think... And there was a lawyer, like a male lawyer, who was quite on board.
So they had to take it, like, that to fight for it, right?
Yeah, they had to fight for it to make it her actual name, not my dad's name. And, so it was successful.
So, yeah, she's been there. But I do remember, I think the issue she was most passionate about was about the council taxes being changed so that your parents would no longer be able to profit from Burwood Casino, Beswood, moving... the council amalgamation, so she wasn't in Perth at the time, but she made your dad go down in March.
Yeah, we spoke about that, the battle for Perth. yeah, very inspiring campaign, that one.
Didn't they have, like, was this a joke, or did they have Indigenous people talking about how their land had been taken and how this is like...
I don't know what of it was made up, like, my
your dad likes
to
exaggerate a bit.
Yeah, I don't know, I've described my dad's account, but I can't work out at what point it was serious and at what point he was just making fun of it, but,
yeah.
In 1788, down Sydney Cove, first boat people land, and they say, sorry boys, I gained your loss, we're gonna steal your land. If you break down your British law, sure, you're gonna hang. Work your life like a combi, with a chain on your neck and hands. And they taught us, whoa, black woman, I shall not steal. Hey, a black man, I shall not steal. Cause I civilize your black barbaric life, and we teach you how to kneel. But your history couldn't hide the genocide. Hypocrisy that was real. Why our Jesus said, supposed to keep the oppressed. I bet it do. Say to you, the white man, thou shalt not steal. Oh, yeah, I'll land you better heed. Your science and technology, hey, you can make a nuclear bomb. Development has increased in size 3 million megatons. If you think that's progress, I suggest your reason is unsound. You should have found out long ago, you best keep it in the ground. They taught us, whoa, black woman, I shall not steal. I said, hey, that black man, thou shall not steal. We're gonna civilize your black barbaric life, and we teach you how to kneel. Bet your history couldn't hide the genocide. Hypocrisy to what is real. Why your Jesus said you're supposed to give the oppressed. I bet it you see you, the white man, thou shall not steal. Oh, yeah, I land you better hear. Me and Neil and Ribner sitting underneath that Indooroopilly bridge, watching that blazing sun go down behind a tall tree, mountain ridge. The land's out. Heritage and spirit here, the rightful culture's black. We're sitting here just wondering, when we gonna get that land back? They taught us, whoa, black woman, I shall not steal. Said, hey, black man, thou shalt not steal.
how to civilize that barbaric lives, and we teach you how to kneel. But your history couldn't hide the genocide, the hypocrisy to what's new. Why our Jesus said, supposed to give the oppressed a better deal than sitting with you. The white man, thou shalt not steal. Oh, yeah, our land, you better heal. You talk of conservation, keep the forest pristine green. Yet in 200 years, your materialism has stripped the forest clean. And a racist contradiction that's understood by none. Mostly that left hand holds a Bible, right hand holds a gun. That's, oh, black woman.